Hello and welcome to Science World. A new report says global temperatures in 2013 were tied as the fourth warmest on record. Meanwhile, a year ahead of a major UN meeting on climate change, the European Union has come up with what it calls an ambitious new climate change and energy policy. A meeting on space exploration that drew participants from 30 countries was recently held here in Washington. For the first time, officials from China's space agency were also invited, which has some saying that this could signal China's possible cooperation in international space exploration efforts. And researchers from Georgia recently discovered that there was an incredibly high level of molecular chlorine in the atmosphere above Barrow, Alaska, a city located within the Arctic Circle. We'll talk with the lead scientist behind this finding and learn what kind of impact it could have on the Arctic's environment. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. A new report says global temperatures in 2013 were tied as the fourth warmest on record. With more on the story, here's Science World's Bob Doty.
The joint report by the U.S. Space Agency NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says every year since 1976, temperatures were above average for the 20th century. In 2013, most areas of the world experienced above-average annual temperatures. Overland, parts of Central Asia, Western Ethiopia, Eastern Tanzania, and much of Southern and Western Australia had record warmth, along with sections of the Arctic Ocean, a large swath of the southwestern Pacific Ocean, parts of the Central Pacific, and an area of the Central Indian Ocean. Thomas Carl, director of NOAA's National Climatic Data Center, says the climate picture played out in more extreme weather events.
We saw, for example, in Brazil, they had a severe drought for the second consecutive year. In many ways, it was probably the worst in the past 50 years. We had an early onset of the Southwest Indian monsoon, and that was contributing to some of the worst flooding in the past half century. And there was many thousands of people killed along the Indian-Nepal border.
Only part of the central United States was cooler than average over land. Small regions scattered across the eastern Pacific Ocean and a region of the Southern Ocean, south of South America, were cooler than average. No region of the globe had record cold during 2013. Gavin Schmidt, deputy director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, says that despite seasonal and yearly variability, the annual report demonstrates world trends and helps get a better sense of what's going on in the long term. For Science World, this is Bob Doty.
Meanwhile, the European Union's executive arm has unveiled what it called an ambitious new climate change and energy change policy for the 28-member bloc. From Paris, Lisa Bryant has more.
Cuts in greenhouse gas emissions, more renewables, and greater energy efficiency by 2030, the European Commission's new climate and energy proposals make environmental and business sense. That's according to Commission President José Manuel Barroso, who unveiled the draft package in Brussels.
An ambitious and smart 2030 strategy will contribute to Europe's share in global climate action, but will also help to reduce our costly dependence on import of gas and oil, boost our green technology industry and sustainable growth by providing a stable long-term perspective for our companies to invest.
The strategy proposes binding 40% cuts in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 compared to 1990 levels. Renewables must also comprise at least 27% of Europe's energy mix by that date. The proposal also aims to make energy production more efficient and competitive and to shore up the EU's carbon emissions trading market, the world's largest. Barroso says Europe wants to shape the debate ahead of a 2015 United Nations climate change conference in Paris.
Coming with our proposals now, having already a debate on this in the European Council in March, will enable Europe to keep the leadership role and also to help shape the global climate action.
Europe already has some of the world's most far-reaching climate change policies, but environmental groups like Greenpeace say these new proposals aren't ambitious enough. For example, Greenpeace's EU policy director, Joris ten Blanken, says Europe needs to cut its greenhouse gas emissions by at least 55% by 2030.
This proposal for 40% emission cuts is not adequate to hold global warming within safe levels. Moreover, we're seeing that the EU is, with this proposal, backtracking on clean energy. Over the last 15 years, a lot of jobs were created with clean energy investments, and it was good for the EU's energy security. But the ambition level in this proposal will give a lot of uncertainty for investors in this sector and put clean energy in Europe at risk.
Experts warn that climate change may produce drastic results, including rising sea levels, desertification in some places, and volatile weather patterns. A recent draft report by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says foot-dragging by nations in fighting climate change has created a critical situation that will only get worse with time. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The smog that frequently chokes China comes partially from factories that supply the rest of the world with shoes, toys, electronics, and other goods, according to a new study. But as Steve Barragona reports, some of that pollution made in China also winds up being exported.
Dangerous air pollution has become a fact of life in much of China. Cars, trucks, and power plants are all contributing. But there's another factor to consider, says University of California Irvine researcher Steve Davis, who spoke to VOA via Skype.
Maybe a quarter of what you're seeing when you see pictures of that Chinese pollution and everyone wearing masks has to do with goods they're making for other parts of the world.
The world has outsourced much of its manufacturing to China. In the journal The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Davis and his colleagues found that producing the world's electronics, shoes, toys, and other goods generated one-fourth of the country's smog-forming nitrogen oxides and one-third of the asthma-inducing sulfur dioxide. 21% of those amounts could be traced to the production of goods bound for the United States. And some of that pollution follows the goods, drifting across the Pacific Ocean. It's enough to affect the air quality in the United States, says Davis.
It could be a quarter of the air pollution in places in the West Coast that's related to not just Chinese pollution, but the export-related Chinese pollution.
The study shows these trading partners exchange more than just goods and services, says Texas A&M University researcher Renyi Zhang, who also spoke via Skype.
What this paper is saying is that China is playing a role in terms of polluting the air in the U.S. But the U.S. is actually playing a role as well because we are exporting the trading to the Chinese.
And according to Davis, that puts some of the responsibility for China's dirty air on the United States and other countries that buy Chinese-made goods. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
A little later in our program, we'll hear how scientists studying the atmosphere above Barrow, Alaska, located within the Arctic Circle, have discovered extraordinarily high levels of molecular chlorine in the air. For this week's Science World Quick Quiz, what is the chemical symbol for chlorine as it's listed in the periodic table of elements? Is it A, C, B, Cl, C, Co, or D, Ca? Good luck! We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Someday, implanted medical devices, such as a heart pacemaker, may be powered by the movement of the body's organs. As Jessica Berman reports, researchers have demonstrated the potential of natural organ motion to do just that.
So-called piezoelectric materials produce electrical current when they are stressed or squeezed. Imagine, for example, electricity being created by stretching a rubber band. John Rogers and colleagues at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign created a low-level current device by attaching piezoelectric materials to flexible ribbons of plastic. When the device was applied to moving organs, Rogers says, the device generated generated little bursts of electric current.
And that turns out to be a useful characteristic because when mounted on an organ like the heart or the lung or the diaphragm, the natural motion of the organ then creates this bending motion, and that current output can be stored in a battery, a tiny chip-scale battery, and then be used to power biomedical implants like cardiac pacemakers.
Other potential biomedical devices that might be powered using piezoelectric current include heart monitors and nerve stimulators. At present, these devices are powered by batteries that require surgery to replace. Scientists tested their piezoelectric ribbons on the human-sized organs of cows, pigs, and sheep. Researchers report their system generated up to 8 volts of electricity, enough electric current to run a cardiac pacemaker. In laboratory experiments, they found the devices remained stable after being bent back and forth more than 20 million times, suggesting piezoelectric ribbons could reduce or eliminate the need for batteries in biomedical devices. Rogers is looking forward to human clinical trials.
It's definitely years into the future, but you know, we're optimistic, I would say, overall, so far so good.
An article on piezoelectric ribbons is published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Space exploration officials from more than 30 countries met in Washington, D.C. recently to discuss how to advance the exploration and utilization of space. For the first time, officials from China's space agency were also invited, highlighting the possibility of cooperation in space exploration. George Putich reports.
Cooperation between the U.S. space agency NASA and China's space agency was banned by Congress in 2011. But there are signs this may change. At the International Space Exploration Forum held January 9th, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State William Burns invited all countries to participate in space exploration.
Now is the time to come together to make space exploration a shared global priority, to unlock the mysteries of the universe, and to accelerate human progress here on Earth.
Xu Daju, head of China's National Space Administration, attended the meeting. The China Daily quoted Daju as saying his participation was a signal that China is willing to cooperate with other countries in exploring space. Scott Pace, who heads the Space Policy Institute and is a professor of international affairs at George Washington University, says the Chinese were specifically invited to be part of the international discussion. But, he says,
there really hasn't been a political breakthrough that would then lead to large, symbolic, direct cooperative activity. There are, however, again, a number of smaller opportunities that I think we can and should be able to pursue.
Pace says during the Cold War, the U.S. cooperated with the Soviet Union on some aspects of space exploration.
It was in very specific scientific areas, earth science, solar physics, some biomedical data. And I think similar levels of cooperation could certainly occur with China today and probably should.
Also present at the meeting were countries not usually associated with space exploration, like Brazil, Saudi Arabia, and Nigeria. Pace says China may be invited to participate in experiments on board. The next place where one might see cooperation with China would be on the moon, given that missions to Mars and asteroids are too difficult and expensive even for the U.S. and Russia. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Most births in the United States take place in a hospital, attended by obstetricians employing the full armament of modern drugs and technology. In response, a home birth movement has sprung up in some places, including New York City. Carolyn Weaver has more.
Emily Jacobs and her husband, Rowan Finnegan, are about to welcome their second child. He or she will be born at home, like their first 22-month-old Elias. The same licensed nurse midwife will attend. If all goes well, it will be a peaceful, unmedicated birth, with no high-tech monitoring, surgery, or drug-induced labor.
And then after giving birth, straight into my own shower, into my own bed with our new family in our home, and there's just nothing like that.
As a medical student, Jacobs has attended hospital births. She thinks doctors manage them more according to hospital protocols than the needs of women in normal labor.
It's not an illness to be pregnant. It's a beautiful experience, and if you feel supported and you have the right kind of support, to labor and give birth in your own home is such a gift.
Home births have risen sharply in recent years to about 30,000 a year, still less than 1% of all U.S. births. The Business of Being Born, a 2008 documentary by Ricky Lake, helped popularize the movement with scenes of uncomplicated births at home, often in a tub of warm water. Other advocates have spread the word with online video of their own midwife-assisted water births. Critics disagree about the safety of home births. A study in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology found that babies born at home are 10 times likelier to be stillborn and 4 times more likely to have serious neurological problems. Dr. Frank Chervenak co-authored the report.
We here on our labor and delivery unit fight for seconds. When an unexpected fetal distress occurs, we do drills so that we plan an emergency cesarean and fight for seconds. If someone is as much as one block away from this hospital, it's too far.
But Tina Johnson of the American College of Nurse Midwives says his study was faulty.
We used a lot of flawed data and drew a lot of conclusions that are inconsistent with all of the other research that's out there currently, including another recent AJOG article that came out more recently, citing that home births, planned home births with certified nurse midwives, outcomes are just as safe as midwifery deliveries in the hospital.
Author Jennifer Block agrees and says women are choosing home birth for the baby's health as well as their own.
Because if the mother has a spontaneous vaginal birth, that's absolutely the best case scenario for a baby. We know babies benefit from vaginal birth. Their lungs, their respiratory health, their gut health, they are colonized with good bacteria.
And Block notes that the experience is very different in Western Europe and some other countries, where healthy pregnant women are cared for by midwives and see a doctor only if there is a complication or risk factor. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
Do you think you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Let's find out. A little earlier, we asked, what is the chemical symbol for chlorine as it's listed in the periodic table of elements? Is it A, C, B, C-L, C, C-O, or D, C-A? Well, answer A is wrong. C is the symbol for carbon. So our answers C and D, C-O and C-A, are the symbols for cobalt and calcium, respectively. The correct answer is B, C-L. Chlorine, with an atomic number of 17, was discovered in 1774 by Swedish chemist Carl Wilhelm Scheele. Chemist and inventor Humphrey Davy gave the element its name in 1810. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Scientists led by Georgia Tech's Greg Huey recently studied the atmosphere above Barrow, Alaska, which is located within the Arctic Circle, and have discovered extraordinary levels of molecular chlorine in the air. Scientists are concerned that high levels of the highly reactive chemical will have some very strong influences on the atmospheric chemistry above the Arctic. Dr. Huey joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about his team's research and findings. Have you determined why there is so much of this chemical in the air?
We don't know the explicit detailed mechanism. However, we're confident that it's coming from reaction on either the surface of the sea ice or snowpack near Barrow that converts the ultimate source of sea salt to the molecular chlorine into a much more reactive form.
Now, I understand that the atoms of chlorine really don't last too long in the atmosphere. Does that have anything to do with any effects it may have?
Absolutely. A molecular chlorine is a great source of chlorine atoms. When molecular chlorine absorbs visible light, which it does very efficiently, it turns into these chlorine atoms. Chlorine atoms can react with methane. They can react with pretty much any other volatile organic compound in the atmosphere, and they can even react with things like elemental mercury.
Dr. Huey, what exactly do you think these readings and these findings that you've made are saying?
I think what they're telling us is that we need to understand the atmospheric chemistry of polar regions better, and that for years we've known that bromine chemistry is important in the Arctic. However, I think our results clearly show that chlorine chemistry is going to play a role, and the chlorine chemistry interacts very strongly with the other halogen chemistry to make kind of a really weird, neat atmospheric chemistry that's different than pretty much anywhere else in the world.
Was this study conducted over a period of time so that you'd be able to observe increase or decrease fluctuations in the amount of molecular chlorine over this city in Alaska?
No, this is really a detailed, let's look at the processes that are going on study. It was not a long-term monitoring study whatsoever.
Besides over Barrow, Alaska, were there any other sites around the Arctic that you'd made these checks?
No, we didn't go there to measure chlorine. We were up there measuring bromine. And the instrument that we brought, our mass spectrometer, so I thought, well, hey, it can measure chlorine as well. And so we observed these peaks, and much to our surprise, they were there in much higher concentration than I think anyone would have thought they would have been. So we weren't focused on trying to measure chlorine, nor were we focused on trying to figure out either the horizontal or vertical extent of the chlorine.
I've been reading a bit about some discussion over readings of increased oxidized mercury. Any thoughts about that?
The primary oxidant for mercury to make the oxidized mercury in the Arctic is almost certainly bromine atoms. However, we're also pretty convinced that the chlorine chemistry is going to perhaps activate the bromine chemistry and so may have a impact on mercury oxidation in that manner.
What about the ramifications that this increased amount of molecular chlorine has in the atmosphere? Is it any indication of perhaps climate change?
No. You know, you have to keep in mind, we've only been there and measured it once, so it's very hard to say what it was and what it will be. However, the thing that we're sure of is that the Arctic is changing fairly rapidly. Obviously, the amount of sea ice, the amount of seasonal sea ice, the amount of multi-year sea ice is changing. That's almost certainly going to impact the chemistry that produces the chlorine. So the chlorine is related to the climate change in the Arctic, and as we have more development in the Arctic and more chemicals released, we may change the pH of snow. That may help activate the chlorine as well. So the changing Arctic is the background on which this chemistry is occurring, and it's very likely the chemistry is going to change as the Arctic changes.
Dr. Huey, I'm just curious, are you planning any follow-up on this research?
We submitted a proposal to NASA, actually. We're hoping to go back and have aircraft-mounted instruments to try to go map out the extent of both bromine, chlorine, and also iodine chemistry, try to hit the full suite of halogen species that might be there in the Arctic.
With this proposal, will you be checking any other sites along the Arctic to check the levels there?
Absolutely. We would have a ground station in Barrow again, and if we were to have this proposal funded, we would be flying a research aircraft out of Fairbanks, Alaska, and out of Thule, Greenland, and we would survey across the Arctic, both the American and, of course, the Canadian as well, and hopefully into international regions. We would really like to map out the impact of the halogen chemistry, and a lot of that is understanding the horizontal extent over which it occurs.
That was Dr. Greg Huey, a professor in the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. We'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.